Well, first, thanks to the organizers. It's a real pleasure to be a part of this meeting. And so today, my general interest is in development, and I wanted to tell you about a system where we think that collective motion plays an organizing role in development. And so in the study of development, it's common to study, to distinguish two aspects. One is patterning, so how you make the right kinds of cells in the right place, and this is a matter of the regulation of gene expression, and most often interpreted in terms of molecular signals. And another aspect is morphogenesis, which is more a matter of mechanical forces. So I think many of you have already seen these images in movie from the development of Drosophila embryo. And obviously these are two sides of the same process, and one big question is how these two aspects are coordinated. And one simple hypothesis, which you could say has been maybe a default hypothesis for some time, is that the patterning of gene expression lies upstream and controls tissue movement. But there's increasing evidence, and maybe that's not a surprise to this audience, that mechanics can feedback on gene expression to coordinate development. So there's several ways such mechanical feedbacks can operate. So one is in, suppose that mechanical stresses could act as a signal for tissue to sense its size and growth control. That it could act to direct gene expression patterning, so then, for example, in the patterning of avian skin. And also there's this example from Thomas' lab showing how mechanical feedback can drive a wave of contraction in the morphogenesis of the fly embryo. And so with these general questions in mind, I've been collaborating with a group of Jérôme Gros at the Pasteur Institute to interrogate these two roles of mechanical forces in development, both as drivers of tissue morphogenesis and potentially as signals organizing development. And for this, we have been using the avian embryo as a model system. So it's a very convenient model for such questions because it shares many aspects of its development with other amniotes like ourselves, but it's also much more convenient to observe and manipulate. You can essentially just crack an egg in a dish and follow its development for hours, if not days. So more specifically, we were interested in gastrulation in the avian embryo, so this early stage where the internal tissues of the body are segregated from the rest of the embryo. And the early avian embryo has the shape of a flat disk, and inside this flat disk, there's a smaller circular region that will give rise to the embryo proper. And the way gastrulation occurs in avians is that cells converge from the sides to give rise to the primitive streak along the nascent anterior-posterior axis of the body. In this cartoon, you can see cells in this upper layer called epiblast converging and ingressing along the primitive streak to give rise to endoderm and mesoderm. So what has been known from a long time, close to 100 years ago, is that this convergence towards the side and extension along the anterior-posterior axis is accompanied by tissue-wide rotational movement, which had been called polarized movement, and to a physicist, this looks a lot like the movement of a fluid. But it was never really worked out if this could actually be described like the motion of a fluid and what the relevant forces are, etc. So that was the first question that we sought to ask. And so for this, the first step was to better characterize these movements. So this is the work of a Mehdi postdoc in Jerome's lab, who imaged embryos with fluorescently labeled a cell membrane. So to give you a sense of scale, the embryo at this stage is about 4 millimeters across and comprised of several tens of thousands of cells. And as you can see in these movies, we can observe and reconstruct using PIV these counter-rotating motions that have been described. Another way to represent the same data is by constructing a deformation map. So we track the motion of an initially square grid. And so here in this plot, the colors will show area changes. You can see in blue the extraembryonic tissue expanding, and in red, area being lost as cells ingress into the nascent primitive streak. And what you might also appreciate from this movie is that just from looking at the deformation of the tissue, we can make out the different territories of the embryo. We can see obviously the primitive streak where area is lost, but there also is an apparent morphological boundary between, at the margin between embryo and extraembryonic tissue. So this is something I need to spend a bit of time to discuss the how we analyze this data, because this will be important in the following. So what we did was use these tissue motions to automatically label the different territories of the embryo. So I'll show you here a movie where we've automatically labeled the embryo proper in green and emergent primitive streak in magenta. And together with the PIV, we can track the movement of these regions forward and backward in time, and in particular, recover that the primitive streak emerges from a region that initially has the shape of a crescent at the posterior margin of the embryo. And with this, we can also, with automatic labeling, we can also quantify in a systematic way the progression of gastration. So the way we do this is look at the movement of points along this approximately circular margin. So you can see, as you can see in this diagram, these points wind around the circular domain towards the posterior. And so we can quantify the progression of gastrulation by looking at the angular motion of these points. So on this chymograph, the horizontal axis is angular position with the convention that zero is in the posterior. Time runs upwards, and you can see gradual convergence of cells towards the posterior by the convergence of these lines towards the center of the plot. Now, the question, as I said, we were interested in first was, what are the forces that drive these movements? And because we had the idea that these might be described like the motion of a fluid, what we tried to do is analyze them in light of the equations of fluid mechanics. So the equations Stokes, which I've written here, which relate the velocity field to the applied forces. And so what you can essentially do when you write this equation is, since it relates the observed motion to the driving forces, you can use the movement to infer what the forces might be. So in light of some of the talks we've heard about a lot of crawling cells, I should say here that these cells are not crawling on the substrate, but it's really a freely floating sheet that's attached by its perimeter and within which motion is driven by internal active stresses. So really what you should do is replace this external force term F that I had written by the spatial variation, or in mathematical terms, the gradient of an active stress sigma A. And so to cut a long story short, what this, when we looked at the velocity forces, what the velocity fields, what they suggested is that motion is driven by a tensile ring at this interface between embryo and extraembryonic tissue. And motion arises because there's a gradient of this tension which is stronger in the posterior. So if you're on the sides, you're being pulled towards the back, whereas if you are in the posterior, because of the curvature of this tensile cable, you feel a push towards the anterior. And so that explains these rotational movements. And so to be a little more systematic, we wrote an explicit fluid mechanical motion where a model where the motion is driven by a cable with graded tension. And when we fit this model, so fit it, a time-dependent profile of tension to experimental data, we found that this simple fluid mechanical model can nicely recapitulate in quantitative fashion the observed movements. So this was really just inferring what the forces might be from experiments, but then we turned back to experiment to try to produce direct evidence for the existence of this tensile ring. And so we did this through several ways, but one of the most direct was looking at the localization of active, so phosphorylated myosin in this tissue, which we found is enriched in tangential cables at the interface between these two regions. And so if you look at a close-up of these images, we see enrichment of myosin, in supracellular cables tangential to the boundary between these two tissues. So what this first part of our work together gave us was a mechanical picture of gastrulation, where this gradient of active internal stresses drives the tissue flows that shape the embryo. But then the question that we have been asking, and I wanted to spend more time on, so this was already published a while ago, and the question we've been asking now is how these movements are organized. So as I said, one simple explanation could be that there are some pre-existing patterns of gene expression that tell cells at particular locations to contract. And in the case of the avian embryo, this is all the more likely that we know that there's pattern gene expression before movement begins. And in particular, it's known that several genes in the Wnt PCP pathway are expressed, are enriched along this margin, and some of them are expressed more strongly in the posterior. So it's exactly the kinds of patterns of gene expression you would need to direct the movements that we have been describing. However, we know from some classic embryology experiments that things can't be so simple. So what we know is that if we cut the embryonic disc into halves, both of the halves could develop to give a fully formed embryo. So this implies that development has to be largely self-organized. And so the way this had been discussed so far in the literature was in terms of a molecular factor. So what one suggestion was that regions in the posterior, which are the site of embryo formation, are the source of a diffusing inhibitor that prevents contraction in the form top expression of genes that are expressed in the emerging axis, such as GGF1, in the anterior of the embryo. However, no such diffusing inhibitor had been identified. So based on our observations of mechanical forces propagating along the boundary of the embryonic territory, we asked the question of whether mechanical tension could serve as this long-range inhibitor. So the model we had in mind is one where contractility, active contraction, self-activates, and the tension that it induces in the margin propagates to function as a long-range inhibitor and prevent the formation of ectopic embryos. And so there was actually some indication in the experimental data, just looking at the patterns of tissue motion, that were consistent with such a scenario where mechanical forces self-organize. So this was looking at the profiles of velocity along this frame. So what when we looked at these profiles, so here x is a position in millimeters along this ring, with zero being posterior as before, and the y-axis is velocity. We saw these very stereotypical triangular profiles of velocity. So here this relatively uniform negative slope would correspond to uniform contraction in the posterior, and this relatively uniform positive slope in the remainder of the ring would be uniform stretching in the anterior. And when we plotted these contraction and stretching rates over time, so this is a chymograph with a position in x and time running up, we saw that these two domains of contraction and stretching maintain a very uniform size, even though the tissue, the underlying tissue, is constantly converging towards the posterior. So this hinted to a continuous regulation of force generation in the tissue. And so, yeah, again, our notion with these that these active forces might self-organize. So to be more explicit about this, we formulated a minimal mathematical model. So as a simplest idealization, we treat the embryo margin as a one-dimensional line with periodic boundary conditions. And we're going to simply assume that the system is fully described by a profile of active tension, which varies in time according to the local strain rate, so the rate at which the tissue is being stretched or contracts. And so there's also a diffusion term that you could imagine represents the spreading of contraction by the recruitment of new junctions into these supracellular cables. And so if you make simple assumptions about the behavior of the margin, what you get in the end is an equation where the strain rate depends on how much you contract compared to the average of the active tension. So essentially, if you're contracting stronger than average, you're going to be able to contract, whereas if your contraction is less than the average along this ring, you will be forced to stretch. And so in effect, what you get in the end is that you can eliminate the strain rate to get an equation only in terms of the active tension, which where the growth or decay of tension locally depends on the difference to its average. And so mathematically, with the diffusion term, this is really the analog of a Turing model, where the this tension propagating from the sites of contraction acts as a long-range inhibitor, in the limit where diffusion of the inhibitor is infinitely fast and has an infinitely long range. So then we went to experiments to test some of the implications of such a model. If we believe that contractility regulates itself and lies upstream of gene expression, it should be possible to displace expression of the relevant genes by manipulating contractility. So this is something that we did experimentally by both up or down regulating contractility locally. So this is an experiment with colliculin beads, which locally activate contraction. And what we observed is a few hours after the beads were deposited on the embryo, an enhancement of expression of GGF1, which is an axis polarity marker in the vicinity of the beads. And also, as predicted by the model, we could observe the formation of ectopic contraction sites, which in some cases would merge together with the endogenous primitive streaks, but in some cases would also give two complete primitive streaks that we also observed when we look at expression of markers of mesoderm like brachyury. And so in the converse experiments, what we found is when we locally downregulated contractility, we could split this initial contractile domain into two separate domains of contraction with low contractility between them. There's also a downregulated expression of GTF1, and we could head from these split contractile domain two streaks, both judging by the movement of the tissue and expression of gene expression markers of mesoderm. So going back to the theory, for those of you who are familiar with Turing models, they're most famous for being capable of undergoing spontaneous symmetry breaking, where starting from a uniform state, the amplification of fluctuations can give you a pattern state. But there are also different parameter regimes where you need an external trigger to form an active a domain of active high activator level. So this was a question for in the embryo: is can embryo formation occur spontaneously, or does it require an external trigger? So to do this, Paolo in Jerome's lab revisited these classic bisection experiments using the new tools that we had developed. So with these tools, what we can do is live image an embryo for an hour or two, observe its movement to infer the location and orientation of the nascent axis, then program a Lazarus system to make an arbitrary cut, then image again the movement of the tissue following that perturbation, and eventually, several hours later, look at the expression of genes of interest, like SNIL, which is a mesoderm marker. And so, to our surprise, what these when Paolo first did this experiment, trying to cut as carefully as he could the embryo in two halves perpendicular to the axes, what he observed was that he never observed embryos forming in the anterior, which was contrary to results in the literature that describe a continuous gradient of embryo-forming potential all along this margin. So it took us a while to figure out why this happened, but eventually we realized that the outward migration of the border cells that are attached to the vitreal membrane, so the process called epiboly, might, by stretching the tissue, antagonize contraction. And indeed, when Paolo ablated a thin strip of cells at the border of the tissue, as you can see here in this experiment, you see this thin strip that hasn't been severed from the anterior half of the embryo, he could observe the formation of one or two contraction sites near the cut surface, and here in this example, expression of a mesoderm marker at two positions. So this confirmed, as described in earlier literature, that the whole margin is competent to form an embryo. And so turning back to the model, we integrated the same simple mechanical feedback that is described in one dimension in our two-dimensional model for tissue flows. And with this, we're able to recover both the wild-type patterns of movement, but now in a model where the forces are not fit to data, but self-organizing. And the model, when we simulate an anterior half, can predict the recover, as seen in experiments, the formation of two sites of contraction and two streaks. Right. So you might object at this point that a molecular Turing model could explain the same patterns and same response to separation of the embryo in two parts. So we really thought to find an experiment that would discriminate definitively between the two. And this came from a property of the model, which is that this mechanical feedback naturally gives you for free a scaling of the active contracting domain to the size of the tissue. So this is a simulation of the same model in half the size a domain, and you get a contracting domain that is half as small, occupying an approximately invariant fraction of the total length. And so if we simulate, now looking instead of the anterior half at the response in the posterior half, the model predicts that you would get a contracting domain that occupies approximately the same fraction of the remaining length of the margin. So you can see here, if you compare these chymographs in a half or in the simulation of the full embryo, a smaller domain of contraction. But critically, this depends on the mechanical boundary condition. So if we assume a fixed boundary, then tension can build up in the remaining margin to function as an inhibitor. However, if we stimulate a free boundary, then there's no tension that can build up, and the model predicts that the whole margin would contract. And interestingly for us, so Paolo was able to prepare embryo halves in different ways, such that their boundary would either be free to slide on the vitreal membrane or reattached. And what he observed is consistent with the predictions of the model. With an embryo that has a free boundary, you can see here, this point here is, there's a fixed boundary. You get a narrower region of contraction, whereas with a free boundary, you can see a broad contraction throughout the margin, as predicted in the model, both looking at the patterns of the Becherin and the chymographs quantifying contraction rate along the margin. But the first question then was, does this have any effect on gene expression in the system? And so what we did is look at gene expression in the same embryos that were fixed after we imaged them for several hours. And remarkably, we found that gene expression was redirected in exactly the same way as tissue motion. So in half embryos where the boundary was fixed, we observed, similar to the redirection of contraction, a narrowing of expression of markers of axis formation, so GDF1 or BRCA3, whereas in embryos with a free boundary, GDF1 and BRCA3 were much more broadly expressed. So, you know, I want you to pause here. These embryos were very carefully quantified, so we know we've waited for the same stage before we performed the cut and imaged them for exactly the same time after the cut, so you can attribute this difference to advection of the gene expression pattern. It's really just changing the mechanical boundary condition that has this dramatic effect on gene expression. So I think this is a really key experiment that discriminates between mechanical or molecular cues and, yeah, demonstrates that mechanics plays an essential role in the regulation of gene expression in the system, and therefore in the proportioning of the embryonic territories and wild type by implication. So yeah, for now I've just shown you experiments that are rather brutal because we're cutting the whole embryo, but if you assume that mechanical forces can redirect gene expression, in principle we could achieve the same effect with much milder perturbations, such as friction, and this is another experiment that Paolo did where he used his own hair as an obstacle to tissue motion, so therefore as an obstacle to movement towards the posterior and the propagation of mechanical force, but without any disruption to the tissue. So if I play the movie, you can see that there's a bit of movement across the hair, so it's really not disrupting the tissue. Nevertheless, if you look at the pattern of tissue deformation, you can see emergent sites of contraction anterior to the hair, similar to the anterior halves. And also looking at gene expression after a few hours, we see the beginning of expression of GDF1 and BRCA3 at these sites. So a very mild mechanical perturbation is sufficient to redirect gene expression, and actually that might even suggest a route for the natural occurrence of twinning, because just a mild mechanical perturbation can give you multiple axes. So in conclusion, I think what we have shown now is this a picture where mechanics play an essential role in the formation of the amniote body axis. And we can think of in this way as the proportioning of the embryonic territories and as an instance of a mechanical homeostasis. As I said, we know from these experiments where we separate the embryo in two halves that the system is capable of spontaneous symmetry breaking. However, that's not the case in the intact embryo because, as I've said before, there is a pre-existing bias in gene expression that provides an initial cue to direct the formation of the axis at the appropriate location. However, once initiated by this pre-pattern, mechanics serves to canalize patterning and morphogenesis. So looking forward, we anticipate that this is just one role that mechanics could play in the system, and also imagine that it's likely that the different territories of the embryo exist in different mechanical states, and there could be a feedback of mechanics in the specification of embryo versus extraembryonic, and so this embryo margin could function as sort of a mechanical organizing for many aspects of development. So to finish, I would thank the people who have done the work, especially Mehdi and Paolo, who did the experiments in John's lab, and Alex Shamali, who's been working on the theory aspects of this project. Thank you.